It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's not easy to plan a wedding under any circumstance. So many ideas and traditions and judgments to consider and weigh, what friends and family might think about how we do this or that. But for same-sex or other non-binary couples, weddings can be even more complex and challenging to navigate. In part, that's because many parts of the wedding industry developed over the years to serve a bride and a groom and didn't quickly catch up after same-sex marriage became legal around the country. Our next guest examined what happens to people in that position where they're trying to wade through a marketplace that wasn't set up to serve them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the wedding industry does or doesn't serve same-sex couples? Are you part of a same-sex couple that's either planning a wedding or had one since same-sex marriage became legal around the country? What was your experience like working with different parts of the industry to put together whatever type or mix of ceremony, celebration, or event you had? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amber Epp is an associate professor of marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. She's co-author of a study on this topic that was recently featured in the Journal of Consumer Research. Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you and your colleague did a lot of this research as same-sex marriage became legal, first in particular states around the country, then nationwide. Can you talk about the sort of interviews and shopalogs you had with the people you talked to?
Sure. So the lead author on this study, Sunaina Valicoletti Schultz, was working on her dissertation project right during the legalization of marriage between same-sex couples. And so we were really interested in how couples were navigating the change, as well as how the wedding industry was responding. So she spent about 2 years in the field between 2013 and 2015, interviewing 30 same-sex couples who are planning their weddings, as well as attending wedding expos and wedding industry conferences to see how the wedding industry itself was actually addressing the topic of legalization at the time.
What were some of the main things they encountered when they went to stores or went to the wedding expo?
I think one of the main things they encountered was just the being constantly confronted by the binary in the wedding script. So the wedding script itself is grounded in a bride-groom assumption, and that assumption carries out through most aspects of the wedding industry itself. And so going to wedding expos and bridal expos that you might see even here around Madison, same-sex couples were confronted with all sorts of, you know, forms that were asking for bride and groom or imagery that was just not very inclusive. A lack of awareness, I would say, at the time among vendors about how to do LGBT-friendly weddings or think more expansively about gender inclusivity than just kind of being locked into the assumptions of a bride and groom.
Now, you're coming at this as a marketing professor. I think a lot of sociologists have looked at these kind of, you know, changes and things like that. What, as a marketing professor, do you see in this about how a business, a big industry, actually the wedding industry, serves or maybe doesn't quite serve a part of their audience?
Yes, I'd say marketing is probably a strange home for this kind of study, because you're right, mostly sociologists look at this. And of course, we drew really heavily on the work of sociologists, as well as historians looking at the wedding industry, as well as marriage and the ideals that are kind of embedded in the wedding script itself that makes it a binary. I think from a business perspective, the reason that it makes sense in the business school is for companies to be a lot more aware of the assumptions that are built into their scripts. So we were looking at it from the perspective of consumers in the wedding market, the couples themselves, and what is their experience when they're in the marketplace shopping and they find an absence of diversity in the kinds of attire that are available, or they confront assumptions of the bride always being the one planning when really it's the groom that's doing all of the work in some of these scenarios, and what happens when the marketplace doesn't recognize that. And so I think for us, we were quite interested in the emotional experience of consumers as they were confronted with this binary over and over, and how that gave them a sense or a lack even of legitimacy, of not being in sync with the script, especially since the script was kind of written without them.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, co-author of a study on same-sex marriage and how the wedding industry, as same-sex marriage became legal, dealt with or didn't deal with that change, and the personal experiences of same-sex couples who encountered that. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Fort Atkinson. Nick, hi.
Hi, Rob. Good to hear from you guys today on this subject. It's very important.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Nick? You've got an experience?
Yeah, so I live just in Jefferson County, just to the east of Dane, and we got married about 4 years ago. We had to make an appointment. We just did a courthouse wedding, but I think it's kind of a shame that, knowing ahead of time that we were a same-sex couple, the only forms they had on hand were for men and women. And so they literally looked at us and said, which of you wants to be the bride? And so far it hasn't caused any kind of legal issues or anything like that, but we were hesitant, you know, and not given any warning other than the day of when we show up for our ceremony, that's how it was going to be. So it's kind of a shame that even at the state level, that's not just required to be on hand for same-sex couples.
And you couldn't, they wouldn't let you like cross out bride and write in groom two or something like that?
We weren't sure if that was going
to
make anything null or void or what kind of legal implications that would be. So we just went ahead, and I guess I'm the bride.
All right, Nick, thank you. Sorry about that, but thank you so much for sharing that experience. Amber, this is something that the couples involved in your study ran into in some cases, and this is one of the strategies you found, saying up front, I can't remember which kind of wedding store it was, yeah, neither of us is the bride, please don't call us the bride. Can you talk about that a little?
This was such a common experience in our data. So not just forms, but as you were saying, just the assumptions of who's going to be the bride. You know, all of the wedding script aspects, who's going to propose, whether both people should have an engagement ring, who's going to walk down the aisle, all of those things come with this assumption, this built-in assumption of a gender binary. And so even though, you know, every couple that's planning a wedding has to make choices about how to personalize the wedding, the couples in our study really had to confront that idea of taking on a role that was meant for a different gender and being constantly reminded that this is a binary. So I think that Nick's experience is unfortunate. It's exactly what we found in the study, that the industry itself was really slow to respond in terms of infrastructure and updating of forms, but also just in terms of questioning and re-examining their own assumptions about who might be participating in this space.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Amber, you and your co-author give different ways that same-sex couples dealt with some of these things they were encountering, and you just used one of the words, actually, confront. In some cases, same-sex couples went in and said, yeah, you're not set up for us. Here's what we're going to need from you. Can you talk about how that went?
So much of that, yes. So the couples in our study had lots of different strategies for navigating and both working with the wedding industry as well as kind of working against the wedding industry to try and get them to update the script to be more gender inclusive. So one of the strategies they used was just direct confrontation to say to the service provider or the courthouse, you know, you need to update your forms, you need to think more expansively about this. Other strategies involved more collaboration. So working with wedding photographers, for instance, to say, okay, here's what our vision is for the wedding, but we know that in positions in photographs, there's some semblance or signals of what gender roles, who's standing, who's sitting, where are people positioned? And we're really conscious about what that means for the way that we're positioned. So they did collaborate with marketplace service providers to say, how could we do this in a way that feels really authentic for us and also recognizes our own gender expression and gender roles. And then other examples are things like masking. So one of the things that we've found in prior literature really is that if you don't have to disclose something and it's easy for you to participate. So really, feminine brides that were just shopping for a traditional wedding dress could kind of move through the space without having to constantly disclose that they were marrying another bride. And so we saw that in the study too. And for us, that was a really interesting point because many of the participants really talked about the emotional toll that took on them as they were planning the wedding, is really trying to navigate this space in a way that protected their emotions, but also allowed them to kind of authentically be themselves.
And another strategy, that experimenting one, where people are like, hey, we're doing something different. We're going to start inventing our own traditions here. Could you talk a little more about what that might have looked like?
That strategy was so surprising to me, actually. Of all the strategies that people used, experimenting was really just going out there to see what feels right. So let me just try on all the different things, especially for instance, brides who didn't really want to wear a dress. They didn't want to wear a traditional dress. Maybe they thought they would wear pants or a jumper. And then they just went shopping and tried on all the different things that felt right. But the surprising thing for me about that was that I anticipated that it would move the industry forward, that we would see lots more, a broader range of gender expression and those sorts of things. But instead, what we saw, at least among our participants, was a lot more of sticking really close to the script. So I'll give you a story from one of our participants, Jocelyn. So she is kind of the bride I described, where she planned on wearing pants. And then her mother-in-law, on a whim, just said, oh, let's go dress shopping. This will be really fun. And she said, okay, I guess I'll do that. I'm not really interested in buying a dress, but why not? It's part of the tradition. And then she put a dress on, and she immediately said she was kind of overwhelmed by this feeling of feeling like a bride. She said, ooh, I feel pretty. And then instantly she judged herself for that and said, oh, that's not how I'm supposed to, this isn't my authentic sort of gender expression. I wanted to wear pants, but this just feels right. So something about the tradition of the script really tugged at her, as well as kind of prior socialization, which we haven't really talked about much, but and that resulted in this experimenting often just leading people back to the comfort of the script. So instead of seeing experimenting as something that opened up possibilities and opened the door, instead we saw it actually just reinforcing sort of traditions in the script and people really sticking closely to that for the comfort and tradition that it offered.
We're talking to Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing at the Wisconsin School of Business, talking about how same-sex couples plan wedding activities when the wedding industry is rooted in a bride and groom world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Are we talking about you and your wedding story? Did you run into some of these decisions and maybe some friction with the wedding industry that wasn't built for you as a same-sex couple? For any kind of couple, did you push back against the traditions in the wedding world? Did you stick with it, or did you end up following the script? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We're talking about a study she co-authored looking at same-sex couples and how they dealt with a wedding industry that wasn't always quick to keep up with the legalization of same-sex marriage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story, the story of you planning a same-sex wedding here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, and maybe the wedding industry, whatever parts of it you dealt with, did serve your needs or didn't. Either way, I'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Amber, I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned, the power of the tradition of weddings, of our social script, of what we expect in this milestone, and the power it has on us if we're getting married and on the wedding business, I guess.
Sure. So in our research, we spent a lot of time before we actually started talking to couples, looking at the history of weddings and reading through historical analyses of marriage and wedding markets, because we were really interested in the kind of where the script comes from and how we learn as consumers and as, you know, individuals getting married about what that script looks like. And so in our research, we did a lot of looking at, you know, popular press and media, the way that we're socialized into what to expect for a wedding through books and movies. I know when I was a kid, I watched Father of the Bride about a million times. And so this provides an image of what kind of a traditional wedding looks like. And then once we get engaged, the wedding industry kind of, there's this machine behind it that opens up that comes out with all of the wedding checklists and things you should do and what should a bride be and what should a groom be doing and those sorts of things. So for us, it was really interesting to think about the participants in the study and the expectations they had for weddings based on their own backgrounds, their own upbringings, their immersion in the cultural phenomena of weddings through media and books and those sorts of things, as well as exposure through their own family backgrounds and weddings they had attended growing up. And then the way that that informed their own understanding of the planning of the wedding. And the example that I gave of Jocelyn just a few minutes ago, trying on the wedding dress, one thing that she said after she was reflecting on it during our interview with her, and she said, you know, as a feminist, I'm not proud of that moment where I put the dress on and it just felt right. And then I bought the dress. And to me, I found that really fascinating because that really shows this idea of the way that the emotional experience that has tied us to our prior socialization and background and the wedding script really comes into play whether you depart from the script. It feels really uncomfortable to do things that are different and that you're not sure are going to be accepted or recognized even by the audience, your family members and friends, but also to align with the script sometimes feels uncomfortable or discomforting because it's not an authentic representation of your own gender expression or your gender roles or the way that you anticipated the wedding. So I think prior socialization and that idea of the cultural phenomenon of the wedding was quite powerful throughout our analysis and our findings.
I wonder what you heard more from people, whether it was, I want to do it my way, but I'm worried that I'm doing it wrong given my own expectations, or I want to do this wedding my way, our way as a couple, but I worry that I'm letting down everybody else in the room, the family members and such who might be expecting that usual wedding script.
Both. I don't know that I heard one more than the other. I heard constant tension throughout the data and from participants in their stories, constant tension between wanting to do the wedding their way, and especially in related to honoring themselves as a couple and kind of debunking the gender roles that are embedded in the script, but also really wanting the wedding to be recognizable so that it was considered an, in quotes, a real wedding or a legitimate wedding so that the audience could recognize all the parts of the wedding that make it a tradition and part of the heritage of wedding ceremonies. So I think that tension between both authenticity as well as tradition was kind of permeated throughout their experiences.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, looking at research on same-sex marriage and how couples in same-sex marriages going through the wedding experience run into an industry that wasn't necessarily built for them. Amber, we hear cases going to the Supreme Court where some element of the wedding industry, a service provider of some sort, says, yeah, I'm not going to provide services to same-sex couples, becomes a court case. That isn't necessarily what always happens, though. There are examples in your research of business providers collaborating with same-sex couples to solve these problems or saying, yeah, I guess we need to change the way we do things. What kind of things did you hear?
Exactly. I mean, we did so intentionally because the study was, we were collecting data as the legalization pieces were unfolding across different states. We intentionally interviewed couples from all over the United States in both urban and rural areas, in places where it was legal and places where it was not. And then legalization came through at the federal level in 2015, right, as we were kind of closing out the study. And so we got to kind of see that viewpoint of places where it was more accepted and where service providers were quite collaborative and interested in opening up this space, as well as kind of the pushback that you're talking about. What I find really interesting is that at this time right now, as we're seeing, you know, new topics on this idea of gender inclusivity and the way that the different wedding industry partners are coming to the table, I think it's even more relevant now. This study is even more relevant now than it was when legalization was first happening, because we're seeing this broader conversation in society around gender and being brought kind of into the center of the culture wars. And so for me, trying to understand the way that this study might help us think about people's experiences with that in the wedding industry, in other places, I think is really a useful way to think about takeaways.
What kind of questions would you have if you were to kick off this study today? You know, years after same-sex marriage has been legalized, what would you want to track to see how things have changed?
I would really be interested in whether and how the script has been updated kind of within the industry. I think it would be useful to do a follow-up study that looked at the way that the wedding industry has or has not kind of questioned its own assumptions. I thought the caller, Nick, who said he just got married 4 years ago in Wisconsin and that the courthouse forms were still bride and groom, is telling, right? It suggests that there's more work in terms of just really understanding inclusivity. So there's, you know, no reason necessarily that the forms need to be gendered, especially given the legal status of marriage between same-sex couples. And so I think doing follow-ups where we're looking at the way that the industry has or has not revisited those assumptions about a binary built into the script, both kind of formally in the infrastructure and the forms and those sorts of things, but also informally in terms of, you know, who's targeted for checklists for wedding planning and who's included in the imagery and those sorts of things, I think would be useful to think about.
Amber, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I had a great time.
That's Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We talked to her today about a study she wrote for the Journal of Consumer Research looking at how same-sex couples are dealing with the wedding industry built around brides and grooms. Still time for you to share your story, or if you know someone who's encountered some of the pitfalls we've been talking about today, let us know about it. Love to hear, especially if you got something in the last year or two. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. On Monday, Planned Parenthood resumed providing abortions in Wisconsin after more than a year-long hiatus. It's a move based in part on a decision by a Dane County Circuit Court judge that ruled that the 1849 abortion ban does not apply to voluntary medical abortions. Here's the announcement from Tanya Atkinson, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin has maintained there were two paths that would allow PPWI to resume providing abortion services, a legislative path and a legal path. A ruling by the Dane County Circuit Court in July made it clear that the 1849 law is not enforceable for voluntary abortions. This Monday, September 18th, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin will resume abortion care at our Water Street Health Center in Milwaukee and in Madison at our Madison East Health Center. In consultation with attorneys, physicians, partners, and stakeholders, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin is confident in our decision to resume abortion care in Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin legal expert about the basis of the decisions by that judge and Planned Parenthood. First, we'll get the latest from our own state government reporter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this decision? Do you have questions about the legal future in the courts of this? There will be more, I'm sure, to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Lear is a state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We heard from the director of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Can you talk a little more about what they said about why and how they're resuming their services now?
So they're resuming abortions at two clinics, one's in Madison and one's in Milwaukee. They started offering those appointments Monday. The CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin said appointments very quickly filled up after becoming available. Their reasoning is a decision from this summer from a Dane County Circuit Court judge. in which the judge opined basically that a 19th century law that has been widely interpreted as banning most abortions actually bans feticide, which is when someone attacks a pregnant person and destroys the fetus. The judge actually wrote that she doesn't think, under her interpretation, that the law bans abortions that are done with a patient's consent.
As I mentioned, we're going to be talking to a law professor about the law side of that. I'm guessing, though, that word from that judge probably won't be the last word. It seems like all parties agree there's going to be lawsuits and legal challenges around this.
Absolutely. The case in Dane County is still ongoing. It's likely to make its way to Wisconsin's Supreme Court eventually. And last week, the Republican Assembly Speaker, Robin Voss, said that Planned Parenthood was being presumptive in making this decision. He said, you know, this is still ongoing. He thinks the abortion ban is still in effect.
You mentioned that we don't know how many appointments, but that appointments were full, according to Planned Parenthood. There's been a long history of protest and counter-protest for abortion providers. Have we seen that already this week?
Yep. Protesters outside the clinics in Madison and Milwaukee this week. WPR's reporter Margaret Faust, for example, was outside the Milwaukee clinic. Nearly 50 people there praying, citing religious faith as a reason for opposing abortions. By Monday morning, there was already, you know, fairly large protest there.
And we mentioned there are likely legal cases to come. Are there next steps in this story that you're watching for now?
Well, Wisconsin's Democratic Attorney General, Josh Call, who sued days after Roe was overturned to try and block prosecutions of abortions under the 19th century law, he's filed a motion asking for final judgment in the Dane County case. He wants Circuit Court Judge Diane Schlipper to issue a final order saying, very clearly, no, the law does not ban abortions done with a pregnant person's consent.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for bringing us up to date today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Lear, state government reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio. She helped us break down the news of Planned Parenthood resuming abortions in Wisconsin. Now we're going to dig into the legal context of Planned Parenthood's decision. Lisa Mazey is a professor at Marquette University Law School. She specializes in appellate advocacy, feminist legal theory, legal reasoning, and statutory interpretation. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, this is a legal argument, I think, that a lot of people will disagree about. Can you break down the argument that came through this Dane County Circuit Court that said, contrary to, I think, what we've been thinking over the last year, medical abortion isn't illegal in Wisconsin under that 1849 law?
Sure. So one of the things to keep in mind here is that when courts interpret statutes, there's a process for doing that. There's a well-established process in Wisconsin that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin has elaborated in case law that says this is how we go about interpreting statutes. And the first step in interpreting a statute always is looking at the text of the statute itself and reading the text of the statute. And that is where the district court judge began, was with the text of the statute. She is able to lean heavily on a 1994 Wisconsin Supreme Court case called State v. Black that had already interpreted one part of this statute. So we're talking about section 940.04 of the Wisconsin statutes, and the 1994 case dealt with section 940.04 sub 2. And that is the case where the court decided that provision applied to feticide, not to voluntary abortions. And so part of the analysis here is there's other than the penalty involved, there's like one word difference between subsection 1 and subsection 2. And it would be absurd to interpret those two provisions differently. So, for example, to interpret subsection 2 to apply to feticide, as the court in State versus Black did, And then interpret subsection one to apply to voluntary abortion that she says just would not make sense.
Now, in the abortion law language, defining feticide as homicide, I want to read a couple lines from it here, quoting, any person other than the mother who intentionally destroys the life of an unborn child, ending quote there, would be subject to a felony charge. And there's a specification. This section does not apply to a therapeutic abortion, which is performed by a physician, is necessary to save the life of the mother. And it goes on. So if I was arguing on the, I guess, pro-life side or against what Planned Parenthood is doing, I would say, well, wait a minute. They make that exception for therapeutic abortion. Doesn't that imply that the initial thing covers all the other abortions that could potentially happen?
Right. And I think that's that makes sense. Now, whether that section could be, if you will, severed from the understanding of the other two is a different question. But the question here isn't so much about the therapeutic abortions. The question is about voluntary abortions and doctors who provide voluntary abortions. Would they be prosecuted under sub one? And the concern after the fall of Roe versus Wade was that they would be. And then, subject to a felony.
We'll dig more into the fine print, I guess, in our law. But right now, Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin is providing abortions to some patients. I want to talk to who might be legally liable. First of all, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, a patient, somebody who goes to Planned Parenthood, receives an abortion, they do not have legal liability. Do I have that right?
You are correct. There is the patient who obtains an abortion cannot, and I want to stress that, cannot be prosecuted for obtaining an abortion. That's in Wisconsin Statute 940.13. So patients themselves should feel comfortable that they are not, should not be in fear of being prosecuted for obtaining an abortion.
Now, for somebody working at Planned Parenthood who is part of providing an abortion, it seems like there's a gray area right now. I don't know.
Yeah. So the statute says any person, right? And other than the mother. So doctors come to mind, of course, but there could be, I suppose, other personnel involved in that process or procedure that could fall under that statute. It would depend how the district attorney viewed the statutory language.
And that's a key point. These things are happening in Madison and Milwaukee. District attorneys in those counties, Dane and Milwaukee County, might not pursue these charges. I believe the Attorney General, Josh Call, he's challenged the current state of Wisconsin law. He doesn't seem likely. If no one pursues charges, then we won't put these laws, these ideas to the test?
That's correct. So, yes, you're correct that the Milwaukee County District Attorney and the Dane County District Attorney, and of course, Madison is located in Dane County, they did not participate in defending or in this lawsuit. So I believe they've said publicly that they would not prosecute anyone. And then Josh Call has said he is not going to, his office will not prosecute anyone. So under those district attorneys, we won't know. The question is, of course, if those district attorneys change, if the people in those positions change, would some subsequent district attorney take a different position?
We're talking to Lisa Mazey, professor at Marquette University Law School, about Planned Parenthood's decision to resume abortion services in Wisconsin and many legal issues surrounding that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of Planned Parenthood resuming abortions as they have in Wisconsin this week? Do you think they made the right decision to start offering them right now? Do you have thoughts on what the 1849 law in Wisconsin means or should be read to mean? Would you want to see lawmakers change Wisconsin's abortion laws? If so, how? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Lisa Mazey, professor of legal writing at Marquette University Law School. She's breaking down the current state of abortion law in Wisconsin after Planned Parenthood announced it's resuming abortion services as of this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Planned Parenthood's decision to resume abortions in Wisconsin? Are you confused about the state of the law, given that's happening? If so, I promise you are not alone. If you're a medical provider, what do you think about all of this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa, this is already pretty complicated. Here's another twist. We had that 1849 law just after Wisconsin became a state. Then a law passed in 1985, you know, while Roe v. Wade is in effect, that seemingly contradicts that 1849 law, though that older law was never actually taken off the books. We've had challenges, including from the state attorney general, saying, hey, no, 1985 law, that's the most current one. That's in effect. How do those two laws play together in our court system?
Right. And that's something that the district court wrestled with here. And again, so there's like there are rules about how courts go about interpreting statutes. And one of the rules about that is trying to make sense of how two seemingly contrary things can coexist together. Right. We presume that there's some logical development of the law. So the fact that there were these later statutes that more thoroughly addressed abortion in Wisconsin, do those impliedly repeal that earlier statute? How does that work? And that, like I said, is something that the judge wrestled with. And in part, she solves that by saying, those were enacted in 1985. By 1994, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had decided that 940.04 covered feticide, or at least 940.04 sub 2 had covered feticide. And so therefore, it's a different statute. It's not the same. And so the other statutes enacted in 1985 can regulate abortion, and that's what they regulate. This other one, 940.04, regulates something different. And that's one way that she resolved the way of making sense with it. Another what we call canon of construction, rules about statutory interpretation, is that we presume the legislature is aware of what the court does when it interprets statutes. So when the court in 1994 interpreted 940.04 in the way that it did, the legislature did not change the law. It did not change 940.04 to make it clear that it did not address feticide and that it was meant to address something else. So the fact that the legislature did not change the law is something that we say in legal analysis is that we assume that the legislature agrees with the interpretation that the court gave the law.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Milwaukee. Jim, hello.
Hello. I just had a question for the professor. If a district attorney in a different county was to interpret the old, 1869 law, to still be charged criminally, could they charge like a juvenile who didn't get consent from their parents because they're not required to? Could they, a different county charge a kid in Milwaukee because there's not like a venue issue with respect to juvenile cases in Wisconsin?
Jim, thanks for the call. I think a couple different things in there, Lisa. First of all, if a district attorney were charging for abortion provision in the state, could a minor's parent be charged for setting up the appointment, driving the kid to the abortion, that kind of thing?
I have not thought about that, so I feel like my answer will be somewhat incomplete. Mm-hmm. That raises for me, it just raises other concerns for me about, you know, the ability of someone to move across the state vehicularly, like driving across the state to obtain an abortion. There seems to be some ability. You should be able to move across the state to do things, right? So I am not so sure. I suppose some district attorney in a different county could, but the abortion would not have taken place in that county. And that seems to me to be sort of crucial to what we're talking about here.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. And Lisa, I know a lot of states have moved toward legislation, making it explicit that, or trying to make it explicit that traveling across state lines might be legal, or anybody involved in the process of transporting anywhere along the way toward an abortion. Wisconsin has not done things explicitly along those lines, as far as I know.
Correct, as far as I know. And from other legal scholars that have considered that issue, they're most seem to think that those kinds of statutes, those kind of laws are going to be unconstitutional.
Thanks again for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lisa Mazey, professor at Marquette University Law School, about the current state of abortion law in Wisconsin after Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin announced they're resuming abortion services based in large part on one circuit court judge's ruling in an ongoing lawsuit. I wanted to ask Lisa, we've got a lot of different courts, of course, here in the state. We had this circuit court judge in Dane County make this ruling in refusing to dismiss a lawsuit related to abortion. Like, what does that mean for the rest of the state? That doesn't instantly make her ruling the established case law in the state, or does it?
No, it does not. And as your reporter earlier said, this case is still ongoing. Mm-hmm. It is not ended yet. It cannot yet be appealed. So once you get something out of the district court and up higher into the court system, you would probably get more clarity on, you know, whether this would apply across the state or not. But right now we're talking about one judge in one court with two particular parties, three particular defendants, the district attorneys of Dane County, Milwaukee County, and Sheboygan County.
Likely, we can't predict the future, but I think it's a safe guess, Lisa, this will probably all end up coming to the state Supreme Court at some point, right?
I can't see how it isn't.
Let's go back to
I think it for sure will end up there.
Time for one more caller. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So my question is, what exactly is the standing that the court recognizes that they have the right to adjudicate this one way or another? Are we just debating where life begins? Are we deliberating women's rights? Which one is it? What is their reason for adjudicating this?
Chris, thanks for the call. Who made the court system part of this story, Lisa?
The standing argument is it's neither of the things mentioned. So here, where the court says the standing, it can hear this case because it's an issue that's unique, a unique issue of interest to citizens in this state, and it has case law to back that up. So because this is an important and unique issue, and it matters to the people of this state, right? It's affecting lives and health and lives, that the parties have standing to be in the court. So this case is about an interpretation of a statute. It is not a debate about when life begins or the rights of women or pregnant people. So that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind here.
Chris, thanks for the call. And Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That's Lisa Mazey, professor at Marquette University Law School. We talked about the current state of abortion law in Wisconsin following Planned Parenthood's decision to resume abortion services. Tomorrow on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, check out the progress of Wisconsin's elk herd and the latest news about elk hunting here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Working in the media, we get a lot of emails from publicists promoting just about everything. Well, here's one of them. Today is apparently National Pepperoni Pizza Day. And an analysis of Google search data rates the top pizza toppings in every state. For some reason, this analysis came from a website that rates online casinos. Anyhow, the number one pizza topping in Wisconsin, this may shock you. Brace yourself for an amazing bit of information. It's pepperoni. Yes, Wisconsin agrees with 28 other states that pepperoni is the favorite pizza topping. Rounding out the top five are sausage, mushrooms, bacon, and chicken. That last one surprised me. I've had some good pizzas with chicken, don't get me wrong, but it beats out peppers and olives and onions, tomatoes. Anyhow, you could celebrate Pepperoni Pizza Day however you want to. This is Central Time.